All right, so while we're setting up the technical magic, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you tonight Don Prosnitz, who is Deputy for Strategic Plan at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and the Homeland Security Agency. He was formerly Chief Science and Technology Advisor to the Department of Justice, trying to get them to think through all these bewildering issues in the new economy. And before that, he was a working physicist working on a subject called free electron lasers, which, if I get to go on and ask questions, will probably dominate the wiki. So, without further ado, please welcome Dr. Prosnitz.
Hey, thank you. I want to talk tonight a little bit about sensor search and seizure. I'm a physicist at the laboratory, and we do a lot of development of sensors, but I'm concerned, so, first of all, about how to use this thing. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I'm a physicist, I should be able to do this. It's awkward asking an attorney how to do this.
Touch the next slide.
Oh, got it. Okay. Great.
That gives me a chance to take my word.
So what we really want to talk then, or at least what I want to talk a little bit about, is sort of this dynamic tension then between the technology we're developing and privacy. If you look at the national security strategy of the United States, it says the greatest danger our nation faces lies at the crossroads of radicalism and technology. So we're menaced by catastrophic technology in the hands of the embittered few. So there's an issue with using the technology sort of on the negative side. Department of Homeland Security, I'm sorry, is not at this point hiring a lot of economists, but they are talking about getting a lot of scientists and technologists involved to try and build detector systems. The war on terrorism, America's vast science and technology base provides a key advantage. So we're going to counter the catastrophic technology with good technology, sort of what they're talking about now. That's part of the dynamic tension. But then if you go look at the Constitution, and here I'm quoting something from Justice Brandeis in 1928, progress of science in furnishing the government with means of espionage is not likely to stop with wiretapping. I'll talk about this particular case a little bit further on. Ways may someday be developed by which the government, without removing papers from secret drawers, can reproduce them in court, by which it will be enabled to expose to the jury the most intimate, and that's a key word too, the most intimate occurrences of the home. Advances in the psychic and related sciences may bring means of exploring unexpressed beliefs, thoughts, and emotions. Of course, we're talking about brain scanning now. So this was 1928. So we have the terrorist use of technology, we have the defense, and then on the other side we have to worry about the civil liberties. So it's a dynamic environment, and somehow we've got to steer our way through all of this. So during the next, 40 minutes, I think, or 30 minutes, an hour, however it comes out, I'd like to talk about the following things. Mention sort of what the challenges are in protecting the nation from terrorists. It's a big problem. We don't have all the answers, but we're going to talk a little bit about it. Very briefly talk about some of the technologies, mainly sensors, because that's what I want to discuss, how that might help us a little bit. But then in a much broader sense, discuss how what the current law, and I say law, but it's really current Supreme Court decisions, have to say about the use of the technology. Key caveat, I'm not an attorney. I have no desire to be an attorney, quite frankly. My interest is really just as a result of my previous job as a science advisor to the Department of Justice, but more importantly, as a developer of technology, I think if we're not careful, we could very well end up developing some very, very neat things that will never be used. So I want to make sure that as we develop the new technology, we're at least cognizant of some of the issues that the legal system is likely to look at. What I did in trying to understand this was really just narrow my search. I looked just at Supreme Court decisions, really, that had looked at search and seizure, and really sort of share that information with you. And most important is there's a lot of information out there. Go look at it yourself and form your own opinions on all this stuff. And if you limit it, although the law can be pretty bizarre sometimes, if you look at the basic principles, I think you can learn a lot that way. So we'll try and get through that. All right, so if you look at terrorist attacks, or the key elements of a terrorist attack, at least the way we look at it, there are three elements to it. Targets, what is it that they're attacking? What weapons are they likely to use? Is it a dirty bomb? Is it a biological agent? That's what BioShield is for. Is it just a high explosive, or is it an airplane in point of fact? And then there's the people that carry it out. So we somehow have to deal with all those three issues. And the tools you have to prevent it or to stop it are deterrence, that is, somehow try and prevent them from even trying. That's a little bit hard with suicide bombers, but you might be able to deter the sponsors of terrorism, for example. You want to detect it and then interdict it. That's the key thing. And what we're going to talk here mainly is about deterrence and detection. I'm pretty sure that if we actually knew where it was, we'd sort of be able to go ahead and deal with it. Well, if you look at the size of the problem, just protecting this country, it's immense. And that's why so many of us are working so hard on it. There's something like 15,000 chemical facilities with ticks. Those are toxic industrial chemicals that are what the EPA calls levels of concern. There's a lot of it on a given site. Those are potential targets. There's something like 100-plus nuclear reactors in this country that are potential targets. We've heard a lot about that after 9/11. There's 75,000 dams in the country. Over 17 of those have over 3 million acre-feet of water behind them. Of course, in our government, they're managed by, half a dozen different agencies. That makes it even more complicated. Over 400 malls that have 1 million square feet, another place where lots of people congregate. And then you can make your own list of stadiums, high-rise office buildings, on and on and on and on, plus mass transit. All of these things have to be protected. My own favorite metric or quantum, I have a quantum of protection. It's about $5 billion. So any one of these systems is 1, 2, 3 quantums to protect. The country clearly can't afford them. BioShield is one quantum, and you can go through all those. If you look at people, we have seen, unfortunately, that one or two people can cause a great deal of damage. Sitting behind this picture of a suicide bomber is a breakdown of the number of folks that come across the borders in this country every year. It's about 500 million sort of events cross the borders every year. That's a person crossing. It may happen multiple times in a year. And somehow or other, we need to find maybe only a few, or maybe they're already in this country. So just finding that the people is also very, very hard. So let's talk about materials. What are we trying to find? These are the weapons that people might use. On the nuclear side, and I'm really just talking about catastrophic terrorism, so fundamentally I'm talking about weapons of mass destruction. So on the nuclear side, you worry about dirty bombs, so something like cesium that's highly radioactive. They're used for all sorts of things. Here's 10 curies in something that's, how high is it? About 19 inches tall, so it's not that big. You could blow that up and cause a hell of a mess somewhere that would have a large economic damage at least. So we have to find something like that. Or a large cesium source like you might find in a hospital, could be 9,000 curies. Weighs a lot. It weighs 3 tons, but you could move it around. And then if worse comes to worse, one of the things you worry about is an improvised nuclear device, an IND. I don't know how big that would be, but as an example, that's a picture of the Hiroshima device. It's a couple of tons. Again, it's in terms of trying to stop that from coming across the border, we'd have to find it somewhere. That would easily fit in a container. That's the kind of material that we have to detect with our sensors. On the biological weapon side, again, it's not easy. In the upper left-hand corner, that's one of the FBI forensic teams opening one of the anthrax letters. Those letters had not a whole lot of material in them. Something on the order of, you can imagine how much was in the envelope. And so trying to detect that amount of material in a building can cause a whole lot of havoc and a whole lot of damage. So we're trying to find something very, very small in our sensors and could be hidden very easily. So if we're doing a search, how do you look for this kind of thing without getting inside somebody's home or, in this case, inside their mail or whatever? In the lower corner is actually a shot of Shimrikyo actually releasing what they thought was virulent anthrax. Fortunately, it wasn't in Japan. They caught that because it smelled bad, as a matter of fact, but it didn't hurt anybody. Nevertheless, you can see the issue is that the agent itself is in somebody's apartment, inside, as the law would say, inside a home, protected. So we have to be able to look for these kinds of things. So what comes across the border? Just in terms of containers, a lot of people talk about 6.5 million containers coming across the border. Those are just the ones that come across the seaports, Oakland, L.A., New Jersey, New York, was New Orleans. I hope it will be again shortly. But there's actually 16 million containers across all the land and sea borders a year. And any one of those containers, you can see there's a ship with something like 5 or 10,000 containers in it, could have material. So how do we go look at those kinds of things? How do we build sensors and look into the containers? They could come in by truck. They can come in by airplane. Lots and lots and lots of different ways for these things to come across the border. So that's the problem. It's not completely hopeless, but it's a hard problem. So what are we trying to do about it from a technical point of view? Well, we're building detectors to try and find that material. And there's lots of different kinds of detectors. These are ones that we happen to have at Livermore, but, well, most of them are at Livermore, but there are other laboratories, universities are doing it, private industries are doing it, a number of folks are doing it. We build detectors around railroad tracks. Does this work? Look at that. Okay. So those are big, I think those are sodium iodine, I guess, sitting across a railroad track. So if the train goes by and there happens to be a very hot source on it, we'd probably see it, and it would get relayed and stop the train further on. That's the theory how that works. We put detectors in buoys that will fit out in a port, in a sea channel. So potentially if a boat comes by, you might be able to see it, depending on the strength of the source. We've done it on land. If you cross some of the borders, particularly in the northwest border, and you're looking carefully, you may see these large white pillars. Those are radiation detectors that if there's something in the car, somebody will pull you over and you'll have to explain yourself what's going on. We've deployed some sensors as a trial basis in airports to look at luggage. This happens to be at Denver, where we put a radiation detection to look at baggage coming through. Those are other kinds of detectors we've had. These are not, some of these are permanent placements, some of them are trial tests we've done. Then we have a whole bunch of portable ones. The pocket pager is lots of law enforcement folks now carry that on their belt. And you probably won't notice it, but they could be walking around in some of the cities, and these things will go off, right? And they go off more often than they would like, actually, and they'll say they may or may not pull you over. I heard of one story in New York City where a law enforcement officer was driving down the road, had one of these things, somebody going the other way, right? The alarm went off. He then had to turn around, keep driving past all the cars until he found one, pulled it over. It turned out it was a salesman that had some sort of isotope in his trunk. But those kinds of things are out there now, actually. There are two other detectors. We have one that we're working on that's about the size of a cell phone. The good thing about that is it's more specific, and it would sort of call somebody, or at least you can relay the information back to get more information on it. And then the one down here is a much more expensive one, which you would use after something goes bad here. Lots and lots of radiation detection, some of which is being deployed right now as we speak. And then, of course, we've also put these radiation detectors in mobile vans, like I was saying. So here's one where we would actually put it in an SUV, perhaps. We actually have a pretty fancy vehicle that says DHS with lights on it and everything. It looks a little bit silly, but nevertheless, we can drive that around. And you can see these then patrolling streets of a city, just looking for things to see what goes on. So if you do a really good job, you network all these sensors together. So you get lots and lots of information, and it all comes together. Similarly, on the bio side, we are putting sensors out. We, the country, are putting out sensors. Up here is actually an environmental sensor. It's got filters on it. That was deployed for the Olympics in Salt Lake City. It collects air samples, and once a day it would go back to a lab to do it. We have another sensor that we put in. That's the Washington Metro system. It's not there permanently, but we've tested it out. You probably never would have seen it if you were walking by, but this thing is sitting there sniffing the air and looking for bad stuff. And it actually has a telephone in it, too. It calls home if something bad goes on. So we've deployed those. And then here's another one sitting right down in New York City. It's near Grand... where is that? That's near 42nd Street, I guess. And we put those out. So again, although you may not notice it, there are actually these sensors out going all across the country, some in trial cases, some permanently. This is actually an Army chemical sensor that does remote sensing that hasn't been deployed, as I know. Well, I don't know whether it has or not in public places, but certainly chemical sensors have. So as you go around right now, these things are out there and sort of monitoring. And then, of course, the most ubiquitous sensor these days is still the dog, not for biological agents, but certainly for explosives. And you will see a lot of that going on, particularly in Washington these days. Depending on where you are and what you're doing, you might even have to... I've had to have... dogs go through my luggage and before I got on a bus, for example, for specific events. So there's lots and lots of things, as I say, going on. All right, so we've got the threat, and now we've got some potential solutions in these detectors. What do the courts have to say about all this stuff, in terms of looking at you and your home? So let's see. So I want to talk first about the Kylo case. Now, how do I play the sound on this one? Did you disappear on me? Let's see. That should work. Let's try that.
Why do we have to assume that we live in a world without technology?
We don't have to assume that we do, Your Honor, but technology has the ability to penetrate into our private lives.
Yes, it does. And we have the ability to protect our private lives as well, and we really have expectations of privacy.
You know what? That's not the one I wanted to play. Try that one. Come on, guys. There we go. There we go. I'm getting better.
We'll hear argument now, number 998508, Danny Lee Kylo versus the United States, Mr. Lerner. Mr. Chief Justice. Case is about thermal imaging of a home without a warrant and whether that constitutes an impermissible search under the Fourth Amendment.
Okay. So what was this case? Poor Danny Lee Kylo, they suspected he was doing some bad stuff with marijuana, that he was actually growing it in his house. And so what they did was they found somebody from the local law enforcement, found somebody from the National Guard that had a thermal imager. They stood across the street and they used this infrared imager to take a look at his house. And they determined from that infrared imager that his house, in particular his attic, was a whole lot hotter than the one next to it. Probably shouldn't have been. All right? They then said, well, you know, that's what they need. They need all sorts of lamps to grow this stuff. They took that information, went back to the court, and used that information to get a search warrant. Right? So this was out. They started outside the house, but then they used that to get a search warrant. They went inside the house. They found the plants, and he was busted. And then he then went on to appeal the decision, right? So what did he appeal it based on? On his Fourth Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, house, papers, and effects against unreasonable, that's a key word, searches and seizures shall not be violated and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be searched. So Danny was claiming that in point of fact, when they used that camera, that was a search, right? And therefore that they had gotten this stuff without a proper search warrant, in which case the evidence gets thrown out of court. So this was at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has ruled on these infrared systems. I told you it was based on indications of the normal levels of heat emanating from the house. It convicted him, and he contested the conviction based on that. So how did they decide all this? This was a decision that came out, and I think the date's actually fairly important, June 11th, 2001. But this was a key, and this was what they call a watershed case. I mean, this has changed the way, this was a major case, it wasn't one of these small points in the law that they were looking at. Whereas here, the government uses a device that is not in general public use. You can argue as to whether an infrared imager is in general public use. You can find, you know, people that do bird watching using infrared imagers. So, nevertheless, this is what they said. To explore details of a private home that would previously have been unknowable without physical intrusion, the surveillance is a Fourth Amendment search and is presumptively unreasonable without a warrant. So, they said, wrong. They went, you know, the search warrant was improperly issued, go try again. So Danny got off. Key thing, of course, is, now that you can debate forever, had this happened 4 months later after 9/11, would the decision have come out the same? And I'll show you why that may be. But as you start to think of all the sensors and systems I showed you, most of the CONOPs, in our terminology that means concept of operations, most of the ways that we would use detectors and sensors would preclude you from going to the judge and getting a search warrant before you use it. I can't get a search warrant every time I want to drive by a house, every time I want to open a container, before you get on BART or whatever it is. That's not going to happen. So we already know that that's a problem. You know, I wouldn't be in business if the technology I'm developing is in general public use, right? We're trying to do innovative things that are new. So we would seem to fail from that. And then, of course, now you can ask, do these things reveal intimate information or not? Well, I can tell you that, for example, the radiation detection systems, something like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 5,000 times it goes off because people have had various kinds of medical treatment, radiation treatment. Now, I would think that's intimate. So if me walking down the street, some officer finds that out, you could argue as to whether that's intimate knowledge that should be protected or not. The NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has actually issued a statement on this that they send out to doctors and patients. It's sort of like having a note from the NRC. So if you get stopped, instead of showing a note to the teacher, you show this to the cop and you say, see, this is all right, I was just treated, and here's the information. And so that's a problem, certainly on borders right now as we speak. So interestingly enough, in this decision, and you find this often in the Supreme Court, these guys are really sharp, and actually, even though they're looking past in terms of things that have happened, they really can anticipate what goes on in the future. So this was the dissent. Justin Stevens said, nevertheless, the use of such a device, so this is, he's saying, under the majority's decision, he was a minority, would be unconstitutional in the court's ruling, as would the use of other new devices that might detect the odor of deadly bacteria or chemicals for making a new type of explosive. So even though this was before 9/11, they were already worried that the decision, at least the minority was worried that the decision would preclude using technology to do some of the things we have to do. And then it goes further to say public officials should not have to avert their senses or their equipment from detecting emissions in the public domain, such as excessive heat or traces of smoke, suspicious odor. Remember, that's what happened to Japan. The anthrax release was a suspicious odor. Odorless gases or radioactive emissions, any of which could identify hazards to the community. So given that we have the technology and we have this case, what are we going to do and how do we get through it? So let's look a little bit then about what search and seizure really means and how the courts typically interpreted these things and what's reasonable in point of fact. So when deciding if the Constitution actually, constitutional prohibition against unreasonable search and seizures has been violated, they sort of looked at three main questions. And remember, I'm talking very broadly and not as an attorney who can argue in detail forever on these things. But the first question is it actually a search that's regulated by the Fourth Amendment? If a private person does a search, all bets are off. Fourth Amendment only talks about constitutional, about government intrusion. So there's a, so you don't even engage the other parts unless you decide that it's actually regulated by the Fourth Amendment. They talk about search and seizure. At least I didn't even think about that beforehand. But when if they stop you to look at your luggage, even before they do the search, they've seized your luggage. So that's also a protected right that you have. So does the sensor use actually require a seizure, and is that permissible? That's the second question we have to answer. And then even if both of those happen, you still might be okay or not okay, depending on which side of the argument you're on, by deciding if it's unreasonable. And, of course, there's a whole lot that goes into definition, particularly in the courts and with the attorneys, and what's reasonable and what's unreasonable. So we're going to try and walk through some of those things. First of all, is it a regulated search? Okay, so until the end of the 19th, latter part of the 19th century, I guess I wanted to say 20th century, sorry about that, a search required a physical trespass. That meant you actually had to go in before it was defined as search. And this case, this is the one I quoted earlier when he was talking about Justice Brandeis dissented. This was a case where the cops in New York City, this was during Prohibition, and they used a wiretap to try and break a ring of people that were bringing in alcohol across the country. And what they did was they had, they knew who the, at least they thought they knew who the folks were. There were telephone lines coming out. They put a wiretap, in those days it was a physical wiretap, on the wire outside of the house. And what they said at that time is a reasonable view is that one who installs in his house a telephone instrument with connecting wires intends to project his voice to those outside and the wires beyond the house, and messages while passing over them are not protected within the Fourth Amendment. So in other words, what they ruled at that point was because the wiretap was outside the house, there was no physical intrusion, it was cool and you can go ahead and do that. No physical trespass, no problem. So that was the original, well not the original, but that's where they were until several years later, 30 or 40 years later. Key decision changing that all around was Katz versus the United States. Slightly different situation there. I don't remember exactly what they were trying to get cats for. But in any case, what the feds did was they knew he used a certain telephone in a telephone booth outside his house. So they put a wiretap outside the telephone booth. The trespass actually differentiated under the previous ruling what we call a spike mic, right? So if I put a microphone and drive it through the wall, that was a trespass. That was no good. But a slack mic, which I just left outside the wall and the acoustics did what had to be done, all right, that was legal because there was no physical trespass. So in this case, in the phone booth, they had just put it outside the phone booth, right? And so the law enforcement guy said they were fine. Well, the Supreme Court in this case said, we don't think so. And they made a major change in the way the Constitution, which of course hasn't changed, but in the way it's interpreted, by saying the Fourth Amendment protects people rather than places. Its reach cannot turn on the presence or absence of a physical intrusion into any enclosure. So this whole intrusion idea, although it's still debated now, largely disappeared. Now, from my point of view, that would seem to be a problem for things like that we do all the time, like remote sensing. Right? I can put a chemical, what's called a LIDAR system, and look at the emanations from a chimney and tell you exactly what chemicals are coming out of the house. Right? So we can think about how we would deal with that. But the key part of this decision that continues to be quoted actually came in Justice Harlan's concurring opinion, and this is the interpretation everybody uses. Fourth Amendment search is one that violates an individual's actual subjective expectation of privacy. So you actually have to believe that you have privacy. If you don't believe you have it, then you're okay. Then you're not okay. And that the expectation be one that society is prepared to recognize, here's that word again, is reasonable. So not only do I have to think I protected it, the rest of society has to decide that's a reasonable expectation. And that, in fact, is sort of the controlling, at least, decisions, even now as we speak, the reasonable expectation of privacy. So now it gets a little bit complicated, because as you might imagine, how do you define what reasonable is? That's not a good technical term. It's not good for requirements as I build things. Some of the considerations that the courts have looked at and what's reasonable is the location. They tend to say you have much more reasonable expectation of privacy in your home than in your car. That's why Kylo was protected in the infrared, largely because it was in the home. The activity revealed. If what you find is an intimate activity, and Kylo, Justice Scalia loves this phrase, he quotes it all the time, he said that the infrared camera might have revealed the time that the lady of the house would take her sauna. And he felt that was a intimate activity, shouldn't be allowable, even though this camera would never have figured it out. But nevertheless, that's what he said, that's an intimate activity, no. You have to take proactive measures to protect yourself. That's why when you put the garbage out on the street, they go through the garbage. You haven't protected it. And then it gets a little dicey when they talk about whether you're protecting what's in your backyard and things like that. Other material being searched for, turns out the courts have said you don't have an expectation of privacy if you're hiding cocaine. Right? That's a contraband substance. So if actually that's what you find, really, society would not realize that you have an expectation of privacy in protecting an illegal substance like that. And then, as we've seen, the technology used, actually, if it's not in general public use, could also be an issue. All these affect then how you would search for WMD. What happened?
Okay. Why do we have to assume that we live in a world without technology?
We don't have to assume that we do, Your Honor, but technology has the ability to penetrate into our private lives.
Yes, it does. And we have the ability to protect our private lives as well, and we really have expectations of privacy.
So then I guess our position is that the burden really is improperly placed on the citizen to anticipate what type of technology the government may come up with. And perhaps you're correct that if it's sufficiently sophisticated rather than something that's very common and ordinary, then it shouldn't be the burden of the citizen to anticipate what they can't particularly know or may not know and then take safeguarding measures. Well,
so that was from the oral arguments in Kylo, and you can see the genesis of why they say not in general public use. The idea being is you can't protect yourself from an unreasonable search if you don't know what tools in this case, the good guys, I was going to say the bad guys, but in what case law enforcement, whoever it is going to use to try and do it. And I think that's why that's why they led to that decision the way it was. Okay, so, but let's talk then about let's see, is that what I want to do? Yeah, no, I skipped one here. That's what happened. Okay. All right. So we talked about all the things that would actually preclude it. Nevertheless, from my point of view, we do want to try and stop the bad guys. So what technology can we develop? How would we do it? Well, it turns out that a search may not be regulated at all if all of it reveals is contraband. I discussed that a little bit. I mentioned that at least when it turns to cocaine. And that goes back to a decision. There's several of them. One of them had to do with cocaine, but the one that really everybody quotes is a decision in Ploss versus the United States. And the situation there was somebody came in through the Miami International Airport. The immigration folks, a little bit suspicious of this guy, didn't quite know what was going on, asked if they could look into his luggage. He said yes, so that was a consent search. But then he then informed them that he was going to miss his airplane if they did it, and they said, okay, go ahead. So he got on the airplane to fly to JFK. The immigration officials got on the phone, called the DEA in New York, and said, this guy's coming in, we're a little bit concerned. So he's already crossed the border and everything, so he's already in New York. The DEA, in the meantime, so the DEA caught him. They found that there were some inconsistencies in luggage tags and addresses and all those other kinds of things. So what they did at that point was they seized his luggage. They went out and found a drug-sniffing dog, right? So there were no warrants or anything, but they found the drug-sniffing dog. The dog went around the suitcase, hit on the suitcase, said there's drugs. They then took that back for a search warrant, opened it up. Right? And, of course, they found drugs. The dog was right in that case. So that then went to the courts, and again, he protested, just like Kylo, this was a lot earlier, and said, you did a search without a warrant. Can't do that. Well, interestingly enough, what they decided in this case was the sniff only discloses only the presence or absence of narcotics, a contraband item. Therefore, we conclude that the particular course of investigation, exposure of the respondent's luggage, which was located in a public place to a trained canine, did not constitute a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And that's because they then decided, and that's been quoted forevermore, that there's no expectation of privacy in contraband. I would argue, you know, anthrax is probably contraband in this context. And this decision has gone further. Just last year, in a case in Illinois, somebody was driving down the road. He got stopped for a broken taillight. And I don't know, sometimes when you get stopped, it tends to happen more the younger you are. When you get stopped for something like that, they might sort of say, can I open your trunk? If you say yes, you've consented, but they have to ask your permission if they don't have some real suspicion. In this particular case, there was another officer driving around that had a canine, a dog with him, had nothing else to do, stopped by this guy with a broken taillight, ran the dog around the car, and guess what? They found drugs in the car again, all right? They busted him. The argument, so again, same argument, wait a minute, I wasn't doing anything wrong, I didn't consent to the search. Right? In this case, which was just last year, the court said, yet again, the dogs only can find contraband. You have no right to contraband, it wasn't a search. You're busted. Right? And then that continued just this year in another case in Texas. That was a car where cars generally are protected less than homes, but there was a recent case in Texas where, again, there was an expectation, just like Kylo, that there were drugs in the house. In this case, they brought a dog around, let him sniff at the garage, or her, I don't know, but the dog sniffed at the garage, found drugs, used it to get a search warrant, and in this case, they convicted him, and the Supreme Court declined to even hear it. So again, they seem to be saying that dogs are just fine. That's not a regulated search, and the argument typically is they only find contraband, and they're great. They never make a mistake. You can find that at least in some of the earlier decisions. Well, we certainly know that's not true. And the court dogs certainly do make mistakes. So the question is, even if I had a detector like this, what sort of errors are tolerable? I have to decide that. Scalia, in one of his oral arguments, said that certainly the search would be unreasonable if 99 times I get false positives. I find apples instead of narcotics. This is talking about dogs. And Souter, in a dissent to that earlier case, one where a dog ran around the car, basically said PLOS was completely wrong because PLOS was based on what he said was a legal fiction that dogs do not make mistakes. He was in the dissent, so at this point in time that's still true. But as we develop detectors, what do? Technically, we can now measure how well they work. Those are called receiver-operator characteristic curves, or ROC curves. And what you do is you typically plot the probability of a false positive. In this case, that means I claim you have WMD or something when you don't, versus the probability that I actually do find it right. And of course, since there's no free lunch in any of this thing, I can always, if I'm willing to detect, if I open every suitcase and I've got 100% of false positives, but I certainly don't miss anything. Right? So that's great for security, right? 100% search. It's not so good for privacy. On the other hand, if I accept no false positives and I'm going to tolerate absolutely no mistakes, that means I never open anything at all, right? That's great for privacy, but it's not so good for security. So somewhere we have to operate along this curve that balances the two. And so one of the issues we have to decide is what is acceptable right now. The courts tend to say that, as I say, dogs are really good. That's probably not going to happen. So where are we on sort of, we actually are building mechanical dogs of some kind or other. We call them mass spectrometers or whatever, but they are things that will sniff for biological agents. This is one at the laboratory that can find a bunch of biological agents. We're going to make it smaller. We're going to run it around the house. Well, we're not going to run it around the house, but we'll put it at ports. You could imagine in the future putting this at borders or something like this and just get people to breathe into it, and you might actually be able to find whether they're ill or whether they're carrying things. Justice Stevens, in his dissent to Kylo again, said even the perfectly discriminating mechanical sensor would be prohibited. So he's claiming that even if I don't have any false positives, that the Kylo decision would say because it's mechanical, not in general public use, I've got a problem. So this would seem to be, we sort of have an issue, and I'll go through how we want to deal with some of that. Next question I mentioned briefly, so that's what a search would be, is this thing a seizure? Well, that's pretty easy, right? So whenever the government stops you, terminates your freedom of movement through means intentionally applied, and that can be coercive verbally, you know, just because he has authority or she has authority, that's a seizure. If they stop you on the road for traffic, that's a seizure. They ask you for your ID. If they stop and look at your car, even if momentarily, and certainly if they grab your luggage, that's a seizure. Primary, secondary, and tertiary inspections are all seizing both you and your luggage. But of course, let's go back to that. So why is that important? Let's go back to that PLOS decision. All right, interesting happened there. Remember what I said was he came into, that was the dog one, came into JFK Airport. They seized his luggage, took them 40 minutes, they found the dog hit on it, and they said, that's cool, that's a great search. You know, nothing wrong with the search. But guess what? Holding the luggage for 40 minutes to find that dog was an unreasonable seizure. They let him go. So it was overruled, not on the fact of on the search, which has become the major decision that everybody's doing in terms of finding contraband. Nevertheless, because the seizure took 40 minutes, which they thought was unreasonable, they let him go. So there's a whole issue, even if I stop a car because it's got radiation and I have to bring in a secondary search, how long can I hold that car? Or how long can I hold a person? Again, the courts are going to decide that. All right, so that's searches and seizures. But then there's also, let's assume that even under those set of circumstances, the courts have decided it is a search and it is a true seizure. The next question I want to talk about is it unreasonable in what they're doing? So dog sniffs aren't even searches, that's okay, but occasionally we're going to do a real search that may or may not be reasonable. And so far there's two kinds of searches that are legal or permissible that are with warrantless, no warrants. The first we're sort of familiar with, it's obvious, if a law officer believes that the crime has committed or is about to be committed. They see you running down the street, they hear the alarm bell, whatever it is, they can grab you. Those are called Terry stops after a case. They can stop you, they can search you for a weapon, they can't search you for other things without articulable suspicion. But that's a really good, you know, that's obvious, that's how we get protected. But the other thing that is probably more interesting and more relevant for this is what about the routine searches, suspicious seizures or searches, that we do not because we expect a crime is going to go on. Those are the custom stops at the borders, for example. In this state, as much of other states, they will stop every car that comes by on Saturday night to see if anybody is drunk driving. That's a suspiciousless seizure. Why are those allowed actually under the Constitution? And then there's a whole bunch of things like that. They may search everybody that goes into a government building, right, without a warrant. Why are those kinds of things permitted? Well, there's three conditions they consider when they do that. Reasonableness, when there's no articulable suspicion. The gravity of the public concern served by the seizure. Is it really, really important to stop this person? Imminent danger is one way to do it. Certainly that's why they can search your luggage at the airport. They think that's a very strong government concern. The degree to which the seizure advances the public interest, that really means does it work? They're not going to let you seize people or search or use technology if it just doesn't work, just because you want to do it. Or if it doesn't actually accomplish the objective that it's supposed to accomplish. If the DUI stops on the road, if they didn't believe that that was reducing drunk driving, they wouldn't allow you to do it. So it has to be effective, not only doing a compelling argument. And then, of course, they balance how much that really interferes with what you consider your personal liberty. You really can't harass, delay, or, as I say, scare the citizens. That's not a good thing to do in all these situations. So what are the public concerns that have to be? It can't be general law enforcement. So, for example, searches at the border, okay, that's not general law enforcement. That's to deal with immigration. They think that that's a different issue. Sobriety road checks, that's to stop drunk driving and to keep people from getting hurt on the roads. That's been ruled that that's okay. You can't do the same thing looking for drugs, it turns out, because that's a general law enforcement purpose. At least that's what they've decided so far. If the Washington suicide bomber is a case of, not suicide bomber, the Washington sniper, I don't know if you remember that case, they were shooting, they were two folks that were running around shooting a lot of people in Washington. If you have a credible, and this is quoted from one of the federal courts, if you have a credible tip that a car loaded with dynamite is going downtown, a credible tip, that's okay to look for all cars. And the comment that the Constitution is not a suicide pact, I think is very apt. So you might think the weapons of mass destruction, if they're important enough, would trump all these other things and you can go ahead and do it. However, you have to decide. It has to be a really compelling interest. It has to be an articulable suspicion. At least recently, one of the courts had said, just because you're on a yellow alert, that's not good enough. Right? In this particular case, was they were using metal detectors to prevent people from getting to a demonstration, it turns out. And the argument was, we're going to be fighting terror for a long, long, long time. You can't use that as a current excuse to say that we're going to do all these things that normally you wouldn't do. We haven't gone to the Supreme Court yet, but so there clearly is a balance that's going to happen in terms of what is an articulable suspicion, what is a critical concern, versus what we want to do sort of routinely. So as you talk about effectiveness, that was the second measure. How are we going to measure effectiveness against terrorists? Because most of the things we're doing, when it really comes down to it, is deterrence. Right? We want to stop them from doing it. That is an extremely hard thing to do. You know, if you try to put things on a bridge, for example, and say, guess what, no bomb came across the bridge, so obviously no radiation dirty bomb came across the bridge, obviously my detectors worked. Right? Well, how do you actually judge that? There are some ways people have measured deterrence. This one is, I don't know if you can see it, but this was one that the DEA did, where they were trying to, along the bottom axis here is the interdiction probability. So what's that, the likelihood that you're actually going to catch somebody doing bad, something bad, and then along this is the axis is that you stop them from doing something bad. So the straight line means when I caught them, I obviously stopped them. So that works great. What you really want to do is stop them more often than you could actually catch them. That's the force multiplier of deterrence. And what these different curves are different punishments, and they did this by sort of interviewing people that have been caught. Would you have tried it if we hung you? Would you have tried you if we confiscated your material? And you can see the more severe the penalty gets, the higher up you go. So there's actually a theory of deterrence, but I don't quite know how to do that when you're talking about a terrorist and you ask them, would you have done this or not? You might do that with a terrorist country, however, and that's certainly what we're trying to do. That's largely the excuse or the rationale for doing all protections at the airports. If you look at those numbers, now this is, I'm quoting a case that's about 15 or 20 years, probably 10 years ago. They had inspected something like 20 billion pieces of luggage and people and they caught something like 40,000 firearms. So that's a success rate, if you mean catching it, is a success rate of a part in 10 to the sixth. So you would have to argue, is it working or not? On the borders, they stop, we know that in California. If you drive north of San Diego, there are occasionally immigration stops where they just stop to look for illegal immigrants. That's something like 0.12% they actually find somebody. That's also been ruled okay. And in highways, that drunk driving, it's like 1.5%. That's also been ruled okay. But the courts are not terribly technical about this kind of thing. They have this interesting philosophy. When the government's interest lies in detecting highly hazardous conduct, a low incidence of such conduct, far from impinging the validity of the scheme for implementing the interest, is more logically viewed as a hallmark of success. So when you think about what that means is, if we don't catch anybody, and we never saw anybody, we're doing a good job. You could also argue if we catch a lot of people, we need to keep doing it because we need more pups. So you sort of have this circular argument that you're just guessing as to what works. And in point of fact, that's what the courts are generally going to say, I think, which is that they generally feel on things like that, they trust the government, the public officials, to make a reasoned judgment as to what's effective and not. So it's not a completely a free reign, but they're going to go to the administration, the government, the agency, if you will, to decide what makes sense or not. Still always reviewed by the courts. So if we're driving around a city with a radiation detection, somebody might say, is it working or not? And we're going to have to make some sort of a case as to what we can find and what we can't and the effectiveness. And I think at least, you know, the laboratories are planning to do those kinds of things. Intrusiveness, I think we already mentioned. The seizures must not be excessively long. Searches must not reveal intimate details. We talked a little bit about that. And then the extent of physical intrusion has to be minor. That's one of the reasons they say the dogs are okay. I don't have to open the suitcase and rifle through it. Although some of the things they're starting to use borders, you might argue, are sort of excessively intrusive. So that's sort of all the law. That's all the law I understand right now. So you now know as much about it as I do. You sort of see some of the tensions between one of the things we're going to do. But as we go forward, at least in my case, and try and develop technology, what does all this tell me we have to be doing? When can these detections be used, and what should I worry about? One thing is specificity. All right. I really want to find contraband and only contraband. In spite of the fact that they may say mechanical sensors are no good, I think the best chance we have to be able to do it and preserve privacy is to make sure that all these things see is contraband. In this case, radiation that's harmful as opposed to what you're taking to cure yourself, in terms of a bioagent, a real pathogen as opposed to something else, real explosives. The quandary we're in is that the best way to detect these things is to get a great deal of information. Weight of the substance, you know, electromagnetic spectrum, occasionally acoustic, optical, all these kinds of information. You might imagine if I'm driving by a house and I use my mass spectrometer, I'm going to find what you had for dinner because those fumes are going to come out. I'm going to find out all sorts of things about it. You know, what do your sneakers smell like? On and on and on and on. So how do we deal with that? Well, it turns out that the arms control community deals with that problem all the time, right? If we want to inspect a Russian missile and they take a warhead off of it, and we want to know that they didn't just say that's an empty warhead, there's really a nuclear device in it, we want to confirm that. But you might imagine the Russians aren't particularly interested in us having all the design details, the classified information. So what we design and build, along with some of the other labs, are something they call information barriers. Right, so what it is it takes all the information into the system, it digests it, and gives you an answer, but it only tells you whether it's a nuclear weapon or not. All the information is encrypted, it's destroyed, there's no way even the operator can get at it. Right, so there's all sorts of modern there's procedures to do it, there's software to do it, and then there's double checks on it. I don't see, in principle, we could do the same kind of thing for that mass spectrometer. Build it so all it tells you is the stuff you need to see and is impossible and certifiably impossible to give you any other information. So that's the kind of thing I think we need to be thinking about, at least for this application. There are other cases where you obviously want the operator to have all that information. And it really has to, if you think again about Tylo, that infrared sensor didn't reveal any intimate activity, but the courts objected because it had the potential to reveal it. So you have to make sure that you don't have the potential to reveal that kind of material. Performance, as I said, you have to say that the thing works. For the technical stuff, we'll do the receiver-operator curves. We can have all sorts of statistics as to why it works and how well it works. That'll be really important, I believe, at some point when somebody's going to contest these things in a court. We're going to have to be able to prove that they worked or not. Not only do we have to have these curves and this data, we're going to have an attorney that can explain it to people. It may, in fact, be the harder problem, but we've got to work on that, too. I talked about seizures. You can't hold things for a long time, so the sensors have to be quick, and then they have to be efficient and effective. That's the way we're going to drive our program. Now you're finding out as we move forward. So message to the people developing this hardware. I think the developers should not try to anticipate future court decisions, but by being cognizant of the traditional constitutional limits on the use of their systems and being by proactive in the design and the deployment of WMD detectors, I think you can get a successful balance. I think it's a mistake to go ahead and build these things and try and get them to operate without thinking about the legal consequences up front. That's just an inefficient way to build something. I mean, we can go fix it after the fact, but that takes years. It's generally costly, and in the meantime, we've done the wrong kinds of things. So that's, I want to then conclude, I think, just with sort of an exercise. I'm going to read something, and you can answer questions later. You can send them in, whatever you called that thing.
The wiki,
all right? So let's do a hypothetical, and then you can sort of take some of the things that we've talked about and see how it would apply. So, and I guess I can provide this to you. I didn't give it to you. But the police in the city of Homeland have just been notified that an intelligence assessment leads national authorities to believe there is a probability that as many as 10 suicide bombers are somewhere in the United States. The warning is nonspecific as to time, location, or target, and is issued as a general information alert. The national warning system remains at yellow. In response, Homeland, these are the city officials, decide to deploy several of the newly purchased LIDAR, that's a remote sensing system, a chemical remote sensing, based explosive detection systems on roads and entrances to their airports, sports stadiums, mass transit facilities. At a distance of 15 meters, the systems are capable of scanning and spectrally identifying traces of chemicals escaping from luggage, clothing, vehicles, buildings, and all the rest. Systems are unobtrusive and fast. Unless you notice a warning sign posted on the police department's equipment van, the individuals are completely unaffected by and unaware of the scan. If the system indicates a positive, you hold the individual for 60 minutes until an officer can be spared for a search. All right, so the explosives are identified with a true positive rate of 99%. That's really good, okay? And a false positive rate of 0.2%. So 2% of the time, they make a mistake. And that's what at least the advertisements claim happens in the airports. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's about the rate in the airport. Although designed to detect explosives, the system collects a broad infrared spectrum. Consultant has modified the software so it also identifies drugs. The Homeland Police have chosen to operate the system so its drug detection false positive rate is about 0.4%. And then that detects a true positive rate of about 90%. So 90% of the time, it's a true positive. So over the course of 3 months, no suicide attacks in the city of Homeland. The Homeland Police Department performs 100,000 scans and detains nearly 1,500 people for secondary inspections and full searches. Although they catch no terrorists, they make 900 drug arrests. All right, so note that of the 200 individuals set to secondary inspection, the probability of one of them is actually a suicide bomber is 0.0024%, and that's because 10 people in the whole country. So you can sort of do those statistics. Of the 1,400 individuals sent to secondary for the drug offense, the probability is only 70% that the drugs will be found. So some of the questions you might think about is the use of the LIDAR, a technology not in general public use, permissible? Does the unexploited capability, or exploited in this case, of the LIDAR to perform general chemical analysis violate a subjective expectation of privacy? Since both drugs and explosives are contraband, is the LIDAR deployment permissible? Does the successful drug scanning transform the random search into a general law enforcement function? And then would the result have been different if we had information barriers so only the presence or absence of explosives were revealed? So I don't know the questions to all of those, but I think they're sort of fun to ask. Well done. Okay.
Thank you.